In August 2019, the Los Angeles Times published an op-ed titled, "We have studied every mass shooting since 1966. Here's what we learned about the shooters." This op-ed, written by Jillian Peterson and James Densley, appeared a week following three mass shootings that resulted in 30 deaths in Gilroy, El Paso, and Dayton, Ohio. The central driver for this decade-spanning study, quote, "We believe that analyzing and understanding data about who commits such massacres can help prevent more lives being lost." For 2 years, Peterson and Densley studied the life histories of mass shooters in the United States, building a database dating back to 1966 of every mass shooter who, quote, "shot and killed four or more people in a public place and every shooting incident at schools, workplaces, and places of worship since 1999. The project was funded by the National Institute of Justice, the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. Data from this comprehensive study revealed four commonalities among the perpetrators of nearly all mass shootings. From the article, quote, "First, the vast majority of mass shooters in our study experienced early childhood trauma and exposure to violence at a very young age. Second, practically every mass shooter we studied had reached an identifiable crisis point in the weeks or months leading up to the shooting. They often had become angry and despondent because of a specific grievance. Third, most of the shooters had studied the actions of other shooters and sought validation for their motives. And fourth, the shooters all had the means to carry out their plans. Once someone decides life is no longer worth living, and that murdering others would be a proper revenge, only means and opportunity stand in the way of another mass shooting." This is all from the LA Times in 2019 op-ed, "We have studied every mass shooting since 1966. Here's what we learned about the shooters." This is by Jillian Peterson and James Densley, and we'll link to this article on the Old Mole webpage. Today, from the Old Mole archive, we revisit the 2015 conversation between Jan Hocken and Kathy Farr about mass shootings in schools through a feminist lens and an eye towards changing the culture of masculinity. Seven mass shootings were recorded in 2015, resulting in the deaths of 46 people and 43 injured. Sadly, the conflict over gun laws and the narrative around the role of mental health in these events has not shifted much, highlighted by the ongoing stalemate on these issues following mass shootings in Atlanta and Colorado last month. Now here's Jan Hocken and Kathy Farr.
Welcome to KBOO, Kathy Farr.
Thank you, Jan.
Kathy Farr is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Portland State University. Well, you've been carrying out research for some time now on some of the case histories you've been putting together on school shootings in this country over the last few decades.
My research actually is on rampage school shootings by adolescent boys, middle and high school shooters. So I have not looked specifically at college shootings, but I certainly know quite a bit about them as well. I looked at all middle and high school shootings that met my criteria, rampage school shooting, in which shooter went into his school or his former school and randomly opened fire. So I wasn't looking at gang shootings. I wasn't looking at somebody who had a particular beef with one other person. I was looking at somebody who was actually attacking their school. The shootings took place either in the school building, on the school grounds, or in one case at a school event, a dance that was held at a nearby facility. I looked at cases from 1995 up to the present and came up with 29 shootings and 31 shooters. There were two incidents in which there were two shooters. The rest were single individuals. So I really had a subpopulation there. I wasn't coming up with a theory and then looking for a handful of cases that would support my argument or my perspective. And I think where we need to begin in all of this, and it's where I began, is with gender. Because all of these shooters, all of the 31 shooters in my sample were boys. And they were primarily white. And in all but one case were heterosexual, which is certainly a norm of masculinity, particularly among adolescent boys. I looked at not only some of the similar traits of the shooters, but also of the schools and communities in which they lived. My argument, I guess, is primarily that we have to consider gender first and foremost. That means looking at masculinity, in my view, looking at norms of masculinity when we talk about things like mental illness or bullying or a crisis in youth culture. We can't do that so generally. This has to be about boys.
And I think it's always been a challenge for feminists, whether activists or academics, how we understand the troubles of men around violence, whether there's too much ego or too little ego. There's kind of this fragile ego variance of that hypothesis versus the enormous grandiosity and entitlement that's fostered in young men. And I think it's very difficult to garner sympathy for men who are so destructively violent. And yet you're saying we're all kind of implicated in a certain way, and that's one way of thinking about a feminist line of analysis is not just these are horrible, bad boys, but how are we all implicated in some way in this behavior?
There's a whole literature that really provides a lot of evidence that indicates that for boys, adolescence is a particularly difficult time. They are looking for their identity, as are girls as well. But for boys, there are very rigid norms of masculinity and what I have called insider adolescent masculinity, trying to present or perform a masculinity that will be accepted by their peers, particularly by their male peers, because their male peers are really the judges of whether or not they have successfully met these criteria. And during adolescence, this is particularly strong. The norms are much more rigid, it turns out, for boys and for girls. So all boys struggle to some extent with achieving this particular status because their masculine performance really determines their status in high school, whether they're going to be accepted or not.
This has been commented on the performative side of these shootings, that these are not just random acts that come out of an explosive moment of rage, but they're heavily rehearsed, studied, mm-hmm. and imagined. They occupy a place in the masculine imagination than is acted out by these boys. How do you understand the performative side of it and what's being displayed, particularly in that they usually end up with suicide or knowing that they're going to die on the scene?
Yes, exactly. To begin with, all of these boys have been angry for a long time. And keep in mind, these are young boys. The median age is 15. So they are very young. The youngest was 11. And I did include Adam Lanza, the Newtown shooter, the Sandy Hook shooter as well, although he was 20, because his case is well known and it was also an act of random violence at and perhaps even against his school. So they've been angry for a long time. Most of them, if you uncover writings in journals, a variety of posts, have been planning or wanting to do a rampage shooting or a bombing or act out against their school in some way. In most cases, they have told peers about it, but that has not been reported. There are so many warning signs. In virtually every case, they had told someone either directly or indirectly. And by indirectly, I mean perhaps a post online or a very violent kind of story. So all of them have severe anger, really rage, I would say. The great majority are also depressed and have been for some time. And some of that depression comes out in symptoms that look more like anger, unable to control their temper, agitated. In my sample, 34% committed suicide, either right at the shooting or shortly after.
Some of that can be part of that acting out of rage is self-destructive.
And that's kind of the ultimate of the anti-heroic act, murder-suicide, and there's some literature about that as well. Not only the grandiosity of making a public statement, because these are very public acts in a way, their performances as well. But in addition to the 11 boys who committed suicide along with their rampage shooting at others, some 75% of them had repetitive suicidal behavior. That is, they had multiple periods of suicidal ideation, or they had prior attempts. So these are all long-term, and as was the planning of the event.
You know, I think you're saying there are multiple dynamics to attend to here that facilitate the progress from the movement from a fantasy to an acted out horrible tragedy. But the common wisdom now, I think, among many conservatives and progressives is that we have to have access to mental health services for these boys and young men. Well, but as a clinical psychologist, I can tell you these are not good candidates for counseling and often scare other people. You know, where there's that much hostility, it doesn't lend itself to self-reflection, to seeing someone, keeping appointments, and developing a kind of relationship that allows you to draw on another person to understand what you're so angry about. There is something to be said for counseling, but it's way oversold in this culture, way oversold. So I wonder if there are other ways of thinking about moving to what we need to do other than just kind of demonizing them, which is, I think, one understandable impulse to just see them as pure evil. But instead, how do we intervene, given that these are scary boys? One reason people don't do anything is they're often scared of them.
Yes, yes. And to the first point, your point about mental health services, a number of these boys had been in some kind of talk therapy. And several of them, their behavior was more consistent with antisocial personality disorder, or what we sometimes just think of as being psychopathic. In a number of cases, they were proud that they had been able to put one over on their therapist. One of the Columbine shooters had been mandated into anger management classes, and he came out of there with his therapist saying that he thought this boy had a lot of promise. He seemed to be smart. He seemed to be somebody who could go on educationally, that kind of thing.
So maybe we need to think about mental health services and support services on a different level than just getting people into counseling.
Yes. You know, like you say, these are very difficult boys. They are very angry. They're not sure exactly what the source of their problem is. Most of them feel very entitled that somehow they were due something. Most of these are white boys, that they were due something that they're not getting, and somebody else is to blame. So there's a lot of external blame placement by them. So it does seem that somehow we need a different kind of support system. At one level, of course, we need to change this culture of violent masculinity, where we see masculinity and admire masculinity that is strong, that resorts to violence if necessary, that will never let anyone take care of you.
You don't back down,
all that kind of thing. And that's really important. And so for the school to take a part in it, that's important. You had mentioned earlier coming up with activities for some boys who are not fitting in so well. And I think that's a very good idea. Some schools, of course, do that. But those activities also have to be valued within the student culture as well.
And that kind of reflection on the broader
supports
for these fantasies that are sometimes acted out need to be challenged.
Yes, and all of these boys feel marginalized, isolated, left out. But some of them, it's more of a perception than a reality.
This is Jan Hawken and Kathy Farr talking today about these tragic school shootings and what we can learn and how complex it is and what it requires of all of us to change the culture of masculinity.
You just heard Jan Hawken and Kathy Farr from the Old Mole Archive, October 2015. In 2018, Kathy Farr published her research, Adolescent Rampage School Shootings, Responses to Failing Masculinity Performances by Already Troubled Boys, followed by Lifetime Punishments for Mentally Ill Juvenile Rampage Shooters, No Hope for the Future. That was published in 2019. Kathy Farr is now Professor Emerita at Portland State University. In 2017, following stabbings of three men on a MAX train attempting to intervene in a racist attack on two young women here in Portland, Oregon, I talked with Jan Hawken about how we can better understand the impulses behind right-wing white supremacist attitudes and violent actions in terms of mental health. The following is a clip from that conversation.
The question of whether a psychiatric diagnosis is a useful way of understanding the situation depends on how it's introduced. On one level, bringing in a psychiatric diagnosis or understanding someone who does terrible things as having mental health issues is a way of arguing against a kind of willful badness. And often mental health interpretations have been associated with a more progressive outlook, that people often do things for reasons not under their own control, and they're driven by tormenting voices. And the point that is often used in the criminal justice system, that people just willfully disobey the governing rules of society, it is a false notion of self-determination. So on the one hand, there is something always important to see people caught in these dramas, even when they do bad things or destructive things or harmful things, as in a way acting out some of their own internal torment. And I suspect that was the case here, that this was probably someone who may have been struggling with tormenting voices. The general psychiatric explanation, if he was psychotic and paranoid, would be it's a way of finding a target, an external target, for the unbearable noise in your own head. And sometimes that is part of a very self-destructive pattern of attacking yourself, stabbing yourself. There are many people who suffer from a psychotic disorder who harm themselves much more than others. But occasionally, you know, sometimes this gets acted out where groups that are identified as the threat become the target. It's also important to recognize, though, that conservatives are very interested in dusting off manual of disorders when it suits their purpose, and that rather than providing services for homeless people, helping people who are very fragile emotionally, who are burdened by tortured voices and have psyches that are very vulnerable to a lot of noise, and there are many people on the streets who do suffer from feeling like they're falling apart and their lives are falling apart. So rather than help those people, the attribution of a psychiatric disorder or mental health issues often is invoked to individualize the behavior, that this is just one crazy person. And similarly with the Orlando shooting, where 40-some people were murdered and 50 people wounded by someone who came into a Latin gay club and massacred people. And so there was all this discussion, is this guy mentally ill? And yes, of course. But then the question is, well, how is the larger society implicated in this madness?
That was Jan Hawken talking about violent actions in terms of mental health in 2017, a year that saw 117 people killed in 11 recorded mass shootings in the U.S., including the deadly attack in Las Vegas. We will link to this interview in the post for today's April 5th program on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Along with being a longtime member of the Old Mole Collective, Jan Hawken is a clinical psychologist, documentarian, and professor emeritus of community and clinical psychology in the Department of Psychology at Portland State University. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in.